Bloom Shapiro, accounting, tax, and business advisors, asking the questions no one else asks, creating solutions no one else can. Because achieving your success is how Bloom Shapiro measures theirs. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived and it's just in time.
Thanks so much for coming back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin and John Krofcik, we're so glad that you have joined us today. And John, we're going to be talking about one of those topics that all we have to do is drive around the city of Waterbury, Connecticut, where we come from, hail from, and we live right outside of today, to understand the concept that we're going to be talking about. And that is, in a nation of grocery chains, why do we have so many food deserts?
You're absolutely right. I mean, you go into any store almost around here and you can buy cheap soda and chips and stuff. And then the good food is usually either hidden or it's more expensive. So they choose to take the lesser, worse food.
Exactly. And then, of course, there are these major chains that don't want to reside in certain neighborhoods and areas. So just as we've had redlining in terms of mortgages, that African-American families historically have been redlined out of neighborhoods, in many ways, the grocery industry has done this red line as well, which kind of contorts my thinking. Because, look, if you are poor in America, not that we have enough of a safety net in many cases, particularly during this pandemic, but there are many people who are on assistance, and that money is guaranteed by the government. So why a grocery chain would decide they don't want to be in those neighborhoods? It really doesn't. But with all that said, Barry Schuster is with us. He is the founder of the Center for Food Service Research, author of How to End Every Food Desert in America. And he can discuss with us, and he does, and he's such a passionate guy, John. I really love talking with him. And he can discuss why we lack these nutritious food options that you mentioned in some disadvantaged communities. And I started watching some news reports to get ready for the podcast taping. And think about it. I saw women taking a bus in Dallas. This is one of the reports I watched. Getting on a bus for an hour, leaving her children, I forgot, with a sitter or a family member, going on this bus to a grocery store, you know, miles away, and then having to go, I don't know, the whole trip took a couple hours, John. Unbelievable. You get in a car today and you go to the grocery store and you're back in half an hour. Well, particularly with what you buy. I don't even want to talk about that. But bottom line, you think about it, and then they can only carry so much, John. So everything is so inconvenient, so expensive, and that's if it's even available to you, all the choices that you have to make about what am I going to bring back to my family for a week and so. And these folks are not going to be calling a delivery service. They don't have the money, the resource. So, John, it really is a terrible circumstance, these food deserts.
Well, this is an awful situation. It's not like there isn't enough food to go around either. I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, we seem to be producing enough food for everybody, and you know, I even wonder what some of these grocery stores do with their food as it gets older.
Oh, the excess food. Well, I do think it's the food pantries. We in our state have an incredible food bank, and we do a benefit for them every year, and they tell us how much of that potentially near spoiled food they get, and they move quickly into their ecosystem, which is really important. But we are going to be talking about what a food desert is today, why the U.S. Department of Agriculture, now you're not going to believe this, Sean, but they have certified 3,000 of them in America. It's unbelievable. And things we take for granted, really, really troublesome. So let me bring to you Barry Schuster. I know you're going to appreciate the work that he's doing and the way he explains this situation. So let's go to Barry Schuster today on America Trends.
With me on the line on America Trends is Barry Schuster. He is the founder of the Center for Food Service Research and the author of How to End Every Food Desert in America. Barry, let's start. We need to define a couple of things. Number one, the Center for Food Service Research. Tell us a little bit about the organization, and then give us your best definition of a food desert, because we're going to be talking about it for the better part of this conversation.
The Center for Food Service Research is a think tank I formed because we work, my main business is attracting disadvantaged students into the school healthy meals program. Your listeners might not know that out of 50 million students in public K through 12 schools, over 60%, 30 million, qualify for the free and reduced meal program, which basically means that if they miss the two hot meals at school, the breakfast and the lunch, they might not get another hot meal that day. Our goal is to bring them in to get healthy meals, and we do this by transforming the cafeteria from long rows of prison-like tables into a themed food court, which attracts the students with, we put in booths and jukeboxes and 57 Chevys on the wall to make it look like a Hard Rock Cafe. We eliminate the stigma of the cafeteria being the place where the poor kids eat, because we make it a place where all the kids want to eat.
By the way, Barry, that sounds great, and I do want to get on to the second question that I asked, but I want to backtrack a little bit because you referenced it. I've done some volunteering for the Connecticut Food Bank where I live, and I know that they've been trying to set up a lot of these programs in the summer months, dealing with the kids who do rely upon these nutrition programs within the schools. And I would imagine that somebody listening to this podcast is saying to themselves, what's happening to these children during the pandemic?
What is happening to the children in the pandemic is the schools are providing meals at certain centers. And it's very good. They're providing a package of breakfast and lunch where the kids can pick it up. The only problem for many of these kids is they don't have transportation to the centers. I've developed another program to feed these kids three meals a day, 7 days a week, to work with school districts to implement this program and deliver the meals on the weekends to the kids, because so many of them don't eat healthy meals on the weekends. And let me put in a plug for Michelle Obama here. Former First Lady did a great thing in 2010 when she had passed the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010, which mandated that all school meals would be low in sodium, no trans fats, and based on calorie ranges for each meal so that the kids wouldn't overeat and encourage obesity. It's a marvelous program, which means that the meals in school are the best meals many of these kids will get during the day. And also, no restaurant in the America has to comply with the same regulations that the school food service program does to make healthy meals.
So I hate to tell you when I used to eat in school, but I can still remember it. And I know I liked it, but it was terrible for me. So let's get on to the food deserts, because we'll then tie it back to the nutrition of these young children and what we can expect their preferences might be going forward. Because I know that there are some who say, well, maybe one of the issues related to food preference is just that it's lower cost in terms of the processed foods, and that it's what's available, and people begin to want those foods as opposed to some of the healthy choices. But you're telling us that in the food deserts, I'm sure you're going to tell us this, there really aren't a lot of those options available.
That is correct. There are 38,347 full-service grocery stores in the country. all scattered throughout America, but basically at higher income zip codes. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has certified 3,000 areas of America where there are what they consider a food desert, when local residents don't have easy access to a full-service grocery store, meaning a full-service grocery store that has fruits, vegetables, meal ingredients, and all, and not so much processed foods, because you are correct, that is the problem. Processed foods are easy, but they are generally high in sodium, and that leads to high blood pressure and other food-related illnesses that we'll talk about, that having access to a full-service grocery store can reduce, because they are healthier foods and also generally lower priced.
Can I give you a desert. In terms of the radius and the numbers of people surrounding a particular community that doesn't have one of the large format supermarkets, are we looking at a mile radius, 2 miles? What generally would be that definition?
Actually, the U.S. Department of Agriculture says if it's not within half a mile of easy access, it becomes a food desert. Can I talk about New Haven, Connecticut as an example?
Oh, sure. Right down the street from there.
Right down the street. Now, Naugatuck, where you live, is a nice area, and there are a lot of the different stores in grocery stores in Naugatuck. In the New Haven area, there are certain areas that are disadvantaged, like the Hill. You might have heard of the area.
Of course.
In the Hill, there are basically smaller bodega-type grocery stores, you know, corner stores, mom-and-pop stores, not any of the major supermarkets, like, for instance, in downtown New Haven, where there is a plethora of larger supermarkets with full-service supermarkets, or even in the Cheshire area of New Haven, with Stop and Shop. Full-service meaning having a very large selection of nutritious foods.
Oh, absolutely. We've got many of those in the surrounding areas around New Haven. Clearly, that exists. And I do know what you're talking about, because I'm closer to Waterbury, Connecticut, and I can just see the north end of Waterbury not really being served as well as it might. And I know the implications of that. I was watching a report about food deserts from a television station in Dallas in preparation for this conversation. And this poor woman, who had, I believe, 3 children, she had to get on a bus. She had to go to this larger store. Of course, it was about 45 minutes away. Then by the time she got there, she really couldn't take that much back, because she doesn't have the capacity to carry it. I mean, the whole thing took about 3 hours of her day, and I think she left the older child in charge. I mean, I can only imagine not only the inconvenience, but the disruption in life and the trade-offs that are made as a result of living in a food desert.
Yes. The whole reason I got involved in this starting last year was in Jacksonville, Florida, we have 2 zip codes that are disadvantaged areas, a 32208 and 32209. There's a Publix that was in that area for 9 years in the Gateway Center. It announced that it was closing, which meant that if that Publix closed, it would leave a food desert. So I decided to find out the reason why Publix was closing in this area, where there are 50,000 people living in this area. And I did some research. I shopped the store. And let me tell you what I found, because this is the reason that grocery stores are not in these areas. There were 140 different types and brands of spaghetti sauce, 235 types of Italian and other salad dressings, 21 types of Cheerios, 110 types and brands of potato chips, 76 types and brands of soap. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. 126 types and brands of beer, 200 brands of wine, and then the best, 230 types and brands of dog and cat food. Now, in this area of 38,000, 40,000 people, Most are on the SNAP and WIC programs. Now, SNAP is Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and WIC is Women's Infants and Children Supplement Money, because we want the infants and young children to have extra money for food, for healthy food. This is all done through the United States Department of Agriculture. Now, they can't buy dog and cat food on the SNAP program. They can't buy beer and wine on the SNAP program. There's a lot of foods that they were stocked on the shelves that weren't selling because these recipients could not use their EBT card, which is an electronic credit card, to purchase these foods. So they're sitting there, and the store was not profitable, so it decided to close. Now, following up what you found, the nearest Publix to the north was 5 miles away. The nearest Publix to the south was 4 miles away. I did the bus schedules. If you got to the bus stop, first bus stop, exactly right time, caught the bus, number 12 bus, transferred to the number 16 bus, went down to the Publix in the south, and only had to walk half a mile from the bus stop to the Publix, and then get back half a mile, and then get back on the bus, it only took 4 hours to shop. Okay, so we have in Jacksonville, we're very lucky, we have a city government that was very worried that there would be a food desert, so they bribed, well, I'm not supposed to say that, really.
They offered incentives.
They gave a grant. Yeah, it's a fancy, it's like giving a fancy French name to something. And almost $1 million for Winn-Dixie, which is a very big grocery store chain, very good, although they're in bankruptcy, to move in. 28,120 square feet, same building. They moved in February. And interestingly enough, Winn-Dixie has three different brands. Winn-Dixie is the most expensive. Bylo is middle. And then Frescoe Moss is the lowest price. And there's a Harvey's, which is middle price. They put the most expensive place in there, with the fancy breads and all the other stuff. So they're repeating exactly what Publix did before, because that's their 1890s model of grocery store chain.
But and that's why wouldn't they have known the type of clientele in the area and tailored it? One of the things that surprises me a little bit about this food desert situation is the fact that a lot of the families, as you say, have subsidies from the government. And if they can tailor the actual program of what they're offering, their marketing program, within that, it would seem that even these stores could be profitable, even if they were smaller scale or offered less choice on some level, but still gave a whole range of choice, including some healthy foods. I mean, there's nothing about the healthy foods that is not covered under WIC or SNAP, is it?
They don't want you to eat unhealthy foods. The U.S. government is very good about encouraging.
No, I mean that the healthy foods would be offered and would be reimbursed.
Oh, yes, definitely. In fact, let me thank you. That's a very good question. You are a marvelously smart person. So now I'll tell you about my neighborhood iMart program that I developed, which is instead of 28,000 or 40,000 square feet, which is a standard grocery store, this would be about 7,900 square feet. It would have only the 500 items that are allowed to be purchased under the SNAP and WIC program. Hmm. We would use house brands because, and I'll tell you a secret, and you're not supposed to know this, so don't listen. House brands are made by the name brand companies with their excess capacity. For instance, I'm a type 2 diabetic, so I eat pretzels without salt. Publix has pretzels without salt as their brand, Publix brand. They don't make them. Golden Flake makes them for them. So the quality level of house brands now is exactly the same as any name brand. Taste might be a little different with a different menu or, you know, seasonings, but quality level exactly the same. So instead of 39 different types of mayonnaise or 32 different types of mayonnaise, there would be three in my neighborhood iMart. Regular mayonnaise, house brand, low-fat mayonnaise, house brand, and vegan mayonnaise, house brand. You don't need 32 different types sitting on the shelf.
Well, frankly, Barry, I think you would agree with me. I get really paralyzed by too much choice. some of it is absolutely ridiculous because they're building all these processed foods that are really meant to get at our sweet tooth and many of the propensities that we have for junk food. And they know us very well, the people who market that type of product, and they work very hard to make it almost so appealing that we can't push back from it, regrettably.
We'll be back with more of this America Trends podcast in 30 seconds. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers over 40 years of experience in a broad base of services from accounting and tax to cybersecurity, technology, and transaction advisory. Bloom's experts will maintain an unwavering focus on your future so you can focus on what's most important to you, your business. Step forward at BloomShapiro.com.
Barry Schuster is our guest. He is the founder of the Center for Food Service Research, author of How to End Every Food Desert in America. So what is the formula, Barry, for doing that? How do we begin to break this down? When you say the number 3,000, to me and to anyone listening, that sounds like an awful lot of people who are not being served.
Yes. Well, let me go back. It's not being served to their best advantage, because right now there are 43 million people getting SNAP benefits every month. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture, once the pandemic hit, they were fantastic. They said these people need help. They immediately raised the monthly amount by 40% on their own so people could have more purchasing power. The key is purchasing power of their money to make it go as far as possible for that month, because what mothers are concerned about is dense calories for their kids so they're not hungry. In fact, I'm going to give your listeners a secret tour of the grocery store so they understand when they walk in what's actually happening to them and the psychology that they're being hit with to purchase stuff they might not really want.
Now, Barry, let me ask you this. Are you going to tell us that all of the interior aisles are things we should generally avoid?
Yes, stay on the outside of the grocery the outside walls, because that's where the produce is, that's where the eggs are, that's where the milk is, that's where the good stuff, the natural stuff is. Everything in the middle is consumer packaged goods, or CPG, basically. Until you get to the ice cream, that's real in the middle. But other than that, yes, the outside is the best place to be. What I'm looking for is one of the top five grocery chains, the national grocery chains, to license my neighborhood iMart program. The reason they would want to is because the total amount on a yearly basis through the SNAP and WIC programs through the USDA has now risen to over $100 billion a year in revenue that they could, if they just focused on the 43 million SNAP recipients and the 6 million young mothers under the WIC program. With my grocery store, which, can I tell you the story of the onion and the strawberry?
Sure, of course.
Okay, all right. An onion. You go to the store and you buy an onion. There's only one time that you will use a sliced onion, and that's on a hamburger. The rest of the time, you're going to chop it up and put it in a recipe. Okay? We're not going to have a lot of onions because they go bad after a while. If you've ever bought a bag of onions, you use the first few and then you get to the end of the bag, they're brown, you throw them away. Same in a grocery store. So we'll have a few round fresh onions, but mostly frozen onions. Then you take what you want, you put it back in the freezer, it lasts longer. Strawberries. A beautiful strawberry is fantastic, especially at this time of year. But strawberries go bad very quickly. So when you go to the grocery store, you're looking through the boxes of strawberries and you turn it over to see which is red, mushy on the bottom, and you put that box away. Everybody does that, so that box goes further and further away, and then nobody buys it, and the store throws it away. They have a lot of waste or loss with produce that goes bad. Frozen strawberries. You take out what you want. You put it back in the freezer, the strawberries last for a long time. Things like that will make it more efficient for people, and also it can be lower price. Now, you might say, but Barry, frozen, that's not as good. Today, the freezing process is makes it actually, they've been testing it, more nutritious than leaving a fruit out for a long time. So frozen is actually more nutritious on a long-term basis than fresh. So,
that's interesting.
These are things that are new because we have new technologies.
Barry, I've got to ask you. I was doing some research online for our conversation. There's a gentleman who is a professor of marketing at Chicago Booth. I believe that's the University of Chicago, Jean-Pierre Dubé. And he was talking about food deserts and the large format stores. And he was saying that in 2010, there was a major investment by the federal government to bring these broad-based large format stores into the communities that we're talking about. And what he posits is that the issue is more about demand than supply. He's saying that the people who actually end up going, even to the large format stores in many communities, have a preference. And that preference is for taste. That preference is for bad food choices, if you will. And I don't know whether that's because for years people have grown up on these processed foods, whether it's easy to break those habits. But he was laying it more at the doorstep of the consumer, and that if the consumer would change the way they purchased and what they preferred, then more of these stores would come in. And he had all kinds of statistics suggesting that he had a case to make.
I never like to blame people for their bad habits, but people can change. I believe, you know, these are U.S. citizens we're talking about, and they're valuable people to our country. We want them to be exposed and have opportunity to have the healthiest foods. Now, are they going to buy colored fizzy drinks? Yeah, but give them the opportunity to have more options of healthy foods, less sodium processed foods, because that's a big thing. Disadvantaged people have a higher propensity towards food and diet related illnesses such as type 2 diabetes, heart problems, high blood pressure, kidney problems. Look, I can talk to this because I'm one of them. I'm a type 2 diabetic. And you know what that means. That's not the Mary Tyler Moore type 1 where you're born with it. Type 2 is when you do it to yourself by eating the wrong foods. And then all these comorbidities that now with COVID, and let's bring this up because this is important. The whole purpose of eating healthy is to avoid the disproportionate death rate of blacks and Hispanics that we are experiencing now with the COVID virus in the future. We want to expose and give them healthy foods, good disadvantaged people, healthy foods, so that they do have the ability to prevent food-related illnesses, like especially high blood pressure, which is a killer of many people. Heart disease is the number one killer in the country. But giving them the option to have healthy foods is always a positive thing.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why I want to get back to what you were saying about what's going on in the school cafeteria, because the logic tells me that if, in fact, young people at that age are getting introduced to better quality food, then they would have more of a penchant for that going forward. And therefore, the supermarkets would see that and begin to offer more of it. And more of it is also being subsidized by the federal government because it makes sense. We want to keep people out of the emergency room. We want to keep our healthcare costs down, which are skyrocketing even before the pandemic. So the question is, can we imagine a follow-on from what's going on in the schools into those who are making decisions about where to place food markets where they can benefit and profit?
Yes. If we train the kids by giving them healthy foods in school for their 12 years that they are in school, and again, that is because of Michelle Obama pushing forward her healthy food program, which it truly is marvelous. If you go into a school today, the range of foods, years ago, everybody thought that school food was delivered late at night in unmarked trucks, so no one saw what it was, and it was mystery meat and all. Today, the food that is served in schools is name brand foods. Tyson's chicken, Heinz ketchup, Kraft mayonnaise. Exactly the same foods that you would buy in a grocery store. The U.S. Commodities Program provides phenomenal food, all healthy for kids. And we want to encourage the kids to come into the cafeteria to eat the meals because they are the best meals that many of these kids will get during the day, healthiest meals. A hungry student can't learn, and we want them, well, okay, let me go back to, I'm going to tell you something embarrassing about me. Can I do that? But don't listen very much.
Yeah, we really want that. We really want you to be totally embarrassed, Barry.
All right. I'm a type 2 diabetic. My health insurance plan was $3,614.40 a month for my premium because I'm a type 2 diabetic. They didn't want me, but they couldn't get rid of me, so they just kept raising the rate. That's for the health insurance. That didn't include the $27,000 list price of the medicines I had to take for all these four different problems or the seven doctors and the copays of that. We can't afford to have so many people having these food-related illnesses in the country. It will bankrupt the country to cover the medical costs for people. It is better to short-circuit these by giving them access to healthy foods to prevent food-related illnesses. So that's
it.
I want
to go back to the Obama administration. You mentioned Michelle Obama. And I had been reading where they had tried to leverage private and the nonprofit sector into making investments in these food deserts. What is the initiative there? Is it ongoing, and has it had any impact?
I don't think so. We still have 3,000 USDA-certified food deserts in the country. Let me explain. And you're very nice, and I got to compliment you, but you haven't asked the one question that you really have on your mind because you don't want to be rude. So I'm going to ask it for you, okay? Here it goes. Barry, you seem to be a nice person. You seem to be fairly intelligent. But what gives you the chutzpah to tell an $800 billion company and these executives that make millions and millions of dollars what to do and how to do it better? Where do you get off doing that? And it's a very good question.
Why did you ask the best question of this interview?
Well, because I wanted to get it out there because I knew you didn't want to be rude. So I'm going to tell you, because you asked so nicely, I'm going to tell you how I got to this stage. You remember when Steve Jobs was working with Alexander Graham Bell, and Alex told him that all telephones had to be connected with a cord to the wall, and Steve Jobs said, "No thanks, but I've got a better idea." And then when Bill Gates was working with Tom Watson of IBM, and Tom told him that all computers have to be these huge boxes, and engineers trained for years have to be the only ones working on it, and Bill Gates said to him, "Well, thanks, Tom, but I've got a better idea." Well, I looked at the way that supermarkets have been run since the 1890s, and I said, you know what? I think there's a better way to do it now because demographics have changed. We have, here's the mathematics, 43 million people. And that was in April before the main pandemic hit. So let's say 43 out of 350 million is 9%. One out of nine people is on the SNAP program getting food assistance. Okay, that's a huge number, but we have the opportunity to influence their eating habits. Now, because one in nine people is going, this is over $100 billion revenue stream per year for any grocery chain that wants to license my program because it's out there and it's growing. Wait till Biden becomes president and he lets the 12 million unidentified people now in America on the WIC program and SNAP program, and the 294,000 undocumented mothers that are having babies every year that are getting qualified for the SNAP and WIC program, and the 497,000 regular immigrants having babies under the SNAP that can be under this. It's huge. We're talking it could grow 50% easily to $150 billion. And that's an amazing amount of money.
Well,
every
let me
year.
Go back to Dallas, because I was watching this report from Dallas, and they offered the city of Dallas $3 million, and none of these operators, these big format operators, wanted to take advantage of this. They said in the report that it was hard to make a profit because of security issues and property loss. Have you run into that as one of the objections?
I plan on it. I plan on getting robbed. No, well, not so much robbed. I don't worry about robbed in the area, but burned down and looted, okay? Because let's look at the reality of it. We got 11,000 cities in America. How many riots are going on right now throughout America where they're looting and burning places versus where we could put 3,000 of these neighborhood iMarts? Seven. There are seven cities. That's it. If we put in a small $7,900 square foot building with the 500 items, it's less than $100,000 in total inventory there. So if they burn it down, first of all, we rebuild, because in most areas you're looking at least $48 million a year of revenue just from the people in the area. So yeah, I plan on it, but it won't happen that often. It's a canard, as we say in France.
Right. Well, it was raised in this particular report.
Yes.
Let me ask you about alternatives. What about these organic farms, food hubs, co-ops, various things that are forming? I know you mentioned New Haven, Connecticut. I know they have a co-op there. There's a food hub developing in Waterbury, Connecticut, right near where I live. So what about those as alternatives, at least in the interim, or as an adjunct to what it is that we know is the problem, which is better, healthier food choices?
The only problem with co-ops and things like that with all natural foods is that they are generally more expensive than regular fruits and vegetables, which are healthy on their own. And secondly, they're generally not set up to take the volume of a disadvantaged population in that area. And again, they would have to be moved to easy access for the local residents, because again, most local residents use public transportation, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Are there any other assists that you would be looking for? What do you make of these junk food taxes? I know we've had it on sugary drinks, and I know that Michael Bloomberg in New York got excoriated by some in the media about that. What do you think about that? Is that an effective thing? Should we do that? Because I've got to say this. One of the most effective industries in America that really comes in for very little criticism is this manufactured process, call it food, call it a food product, because it's not really food, but it's easy to get hooked on it for all of us. It's so appealing. They do such incredible science to get us interested in this food, and then it's hard to wean us off of it.
It's like drugs. The dopamine, it hits the dopamine level of the brain, and you want more. It's like that one potato chip you can't eat. You go through, you tell yourself, I'm just going to have one, and then the bag is empty. You know, that's designed that way. It's part of the food manufacturing so that you buy more, but you don't have to. You have the choice of making a decision that you either eat it or you don't eat it. The taxes are a punitive measure, and sometimes punitive works. But more importantly, giving people more access to more healthy foods will, I think, overcome a lot of that. And again, the regulations for USDA are very strict on what they can use to purchase foods. USDA wants you to buy healthy foods. Now, that's on the left hand. On the right hand, you want to know what the USDA is great about? It helps farmers. The more money they give to recipients of SNAP and WIC, the more farmers get to sell products to the government for processing. It works very well for both groups. So we want to encourage healthy foods for everybody. We want to encourage the farmers to do well. And it makes us all self-sufficient and gives us more options for healthy foods.
Barry, having developed your own program for solving this problem, how are you doing with the IMARC program? What are you looking for? How do you want people to support you in that? As we close out this interview, a very interesting one as well. Tell us what we can do.
Well, first of all, I want to make a gift to all of your listeners. The book that I wrote, How to End Every Food Desert in America, if they will email me, I will send them a free e-book of the whole book for them, because it's something everybody should know about. It affects everybody, because sooner or later, if we don't do something good to make healthy people, our taxes will raise to pay for the Medicare and other medical costs. So it is to everybody's benefit to feed people healthy foods everywhere. So I'll give my email address,
sure,
which is Barry, B-A-R-R-Y, at, and then Barry Schuster, B-A-R-R-Y-S-C-H-U-S-T-E-R, dot L-I-V-E. That's Barry at barryschuster.live. I'll be happy to send them a free copy of my book, the PDF version, so they've got it immediately. I'll send you one, so in case any of your people call you, you can send it to them also. But more importantly, I'm publicizing this concept because I want to get it out there to help people. And I want one of the five grocery store chains to get ideas and get their nostrils flaring like a hog in heat when they hear about $100 billion a year revenue stream.
I understand, and it does baffle me too. In a nation of grocery chains, why do we have food deserts? That's the topic that we've been exploring today on America Trends. And Barry, I hope if we talk again that that number has gone from 3,000 down to something much more manageable and something that makes more sense to all of us and that provides the options that people need throughout our country. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this very important topic. Appreciate it, Larry.
America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com. Bloom Shapiro, New England's largest independent business advisor, delivers 40 years of experience in industries from manufacturing to professional services to nonprofits.